Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing this week, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much. I am in Charlottesville again, and the weather is very Scottish outside at the moment.
Really? Okay.
Yes, it's wet and gray and a bit dreek.
Ah, well, here in Scotland, we've got blue skies, so I guess everything's backwards.
Okay.
So two of the big stories in the news this week is a story about voter registration in Georgia, where it appears as if 53,000 voter registrations have been put on hold as a consequence of what is known as an exact match voter policy in Georgia. And in North Dakota, a state law was upheld that required a ID with a postal address, which many people feel is intending to disenfranchise the native populations of North Dakota, many of whom do not have a postal address. So we thought this week we would talk about voter suppression and whether voter suppression is a prevalent phenomenon now and how it's sort of played out in the past.
Yes, David, this is an incredibly important topic, and we will talk about it. But before we do that, I need to interrupt you, and I want to offer you as much time as you would like. It's kind of open mic night here at Catch a Rising Star, because David, I want to give you – President Trump over the weekend, I think it was Friday night, at a rally in Ohio, at one of his rallies, he was riffing as he's wont to do, and he had a lot to say, or he had something to say about both Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant. And given that you are an expert in the history of the Civil War and the Civil War era, I would like to give you as much time as you need to respond to President Trump.
Trump's comments had caused all kinds of backlash on Twitter and on regular old mainstream media. And part of what Trump, I think, if I want to be charitable, actually, let me deal with the backlash first before I do the charitable interpretation. So he seems to compare Robert E. Lee and Grant, which is obviously a comparison that lots of people have made in the past, them being the two most significant generals in the Civil War. And he seems to say that Lee was the better general and that Grant was something of an alcoholic, which is a jibe that has been tossed at Grant for many, many years. And in some ways, what Trump was saying fit into, you know, very much the lost cause narrative about these two generals and their respective abilities, that Lee was the superior general and that Grant was able to win because of superior numbers rather than any particular artifice or skill on the battlefield. And this was particularly pressing that offensive to some people because he made these statements in his usual sort of jumbled way in Ohio, which is Grant's home state. The charitable interpretation, I think, if we're going to offer one, is that he was trying to say that Grant beat a very impressive general. And therefore, he was trying to do a weird compliment for Grant for the home crowd of Grant fans in Ohio. But that's not the way it came across, at least on the clips I saw on television. It made it seem very much like he thought that Lee was the superior general. And, of course, he did so without really articulating what either man was fighting for. What was your thoughts on the...
I thought... Well, one of the themes that we've developed over the course of these this podcast and our various episodes when we've talked about Donald Trump's understanding of history is that his understanding of history is really kind of fixed from the middle 20th century. It's sort of a jumble of whatever he seems to have remembered from school, interpreted through the prism of his politics and his age and what have you. And this seemed to be another example of that, you know, the sort of lost cause, Lee as hero theme, as you know better than me, is well entrenched in certain quarters, and evidence of the contrary isn't especially welcome. In the context of the dispute and the debate over Confederate monuments, which we've discussed many times, You know, he seemed to be yet again coming out on the side of those who subscribe to the lost cause interpretation.
Yes.
The other thing I thought, and this is good for you, not necessarily for the rest of us in the historical profession, is God damn it, the Civil War just never goes away for this guy. I mean, he did have the weird mention of Washington a few weeks ago, but I mean, he seems to be obsessed with it. In when he wants to mangle history, that's where he goes.
Yeah, although now, that's easy to do.
It is easy to do, and in part, I think it's a really important. Well, this more cynical view would be the Civil War is especially important to many of his supporters, and a particular interpretation of the Civil War is very important to, in the white nationalist movement. And so to a certain extent, I think he's crazy like a fox when he says these things. But I just think it's interesting the importance the Civil War has assumed in our contemporary political discourse.
Yes. One of the interesting things, spins I've heard on this, is that in talking about Grant's use of alcohol, was he making some kind of allusion to Brett Kavanaugh?
Interesting. Interesting.
And I don't know what, but I mean, so part of, I think he might have been saying, look, here is a person who was a great general and he drank, much in the same way as Brett Kavanaugh could be a great Supreme Court justice. And maybe I'm reading too much into it. As with much of what Trump says about the past, he seems to sort of riff without pre-planning. I mean, or if he is pre-planning things, he's, you know, doing it on a level that I don't understand, because it does seem like it's just, you know, the thought comes in his head and it goes out of his mouth. But I think
Did you see the tweet that went around? In fact, I might have retweeted it. I'm sorry. I ought to be able to credit the person who wrote it, and I can't. The person who said, paraphrasing Brett Kavanaugh of Grant, I like whiskey. I drank whiskey. I like whiskey. I still like whiskey. And then it, parenthetically, I think, said, and I beat Robert E. Lee.
Yes. And just for those people who care about these kinds of things, most historians who have looked at Grant's use of alcohol have concluded basically that Grant at certain points in time drank more than he should, that he often drank when he was lonely. There's times when he was, abusing the bottle. But that most historians, at least most Grant historians now, do not think it actually had a meaningful impact on the way he fought battles. He didn't drink before battle. He didn't drink during battle. It tends to be actually at those times, other times that he used alcohol too much. Take that for what you will. Obviously, there were rumors during the Civil War that he drank too much, but lots of people in the 19th century drank too much.
Well, people in the 19th century, this might be something we talk about sometime, drank much more than people today do.
Oh, to be sure, right.
For one thing, but that's a topic for another day, I guess.
Yeah, I think it is. All right, so let's go back to voter suppression, go from Grant's alcoholism or lack thereof. He definitely had a cigar problem because that killed him. But to voter suppression. Is there any voter suppression that is the way we would frame it, Frank, in the 18th or early 19th century?
I would say not as we would frame it. And that's not to say there isn't political chicanery going on. I think that in the 18th century in particular, in pre-revolutionary America, for example, the franchise, and historians debate how democratic in quotation marks we should describe colonial America as being. But there were democratic features in colonial politics, namely that the franchise, the right to vote, was more widespread in most cases than it was in Britain at the time. The franchise was usually tied, or almost always tied, to ownership of property. And so I think what's important for us to think about when we think about the history of voting in the United States is a transition happens. Before independence, and indeed down to about the 1830s, the right to vote was kind of conferred in almost a collective way, in the sense that male heads of household were expected to exercise the franchise on behalf of the households of which they were head. Mm-hmm. And by this I mean, so it wasn't necessary, it was not seen to be necessary to enfranchise, for example, women or enslaved people or children, because their interests were represented when the head of their household, who was a property-owning male, mm-hmm. Cast, I won't say his ballot, because to a large extent, as the theory goes, he was casting a ballot on behalf of his family.
Okay, and, but Frank, just to interrupt, it's elite white men who are saying that they are casting ballots not on behalf of themselves, but on behalf of their families.
Well, not just elite men, though. I mean, this is a crucial difference, and particularly in the northern colonies, then states, a large proportion, a surprisingly large proportion of men meet the property owning property owning requirements to vote. And indeed, even in the South, I mean, I'm sitting here I'm actually inside of Monticello right now in the office I'm sitting in. You know, Thomas Jefferson, when he was considering, when he was proposing reforms to the Virginia Constitution, adopted during the American Revolution, suggested giving all adult white men in Virginia enough property to meet the property requirements. So they would have given them property from the public domain to meet the property requirements. The argument being that you have to meet the property requirement for voting, because that would mean you're independent and you're not subject to corruption. If you own enough property to vote, you are an independent individual or an independent man who's a head of household. So, I mean, David, I sense the skepticism in your voice, and that's absolutely appropriate. But it's not just a small number of elite men who are casting ballots. I mean, voting is more widespread than that. I think the crucial change that happens is in the 1830s or the 1820s and 30s, with the rise of what we call in a shorthand, and it's problematic, as you know better than me, Jacksonian democracy. So what happens is, after the revolution, in each of the states, the newly independent states, they gradually relax the property requirements for voting. And so that by the 1830s, by the age of Andrew Jackson, we have what was then called universal manhood suffrage. We don't call it that anymore because it was not universal, although it did only apply to men, which is that by about the 1830s, most white males, at least white male citizens in the United States, can vote irrespective of property requirements. And then what happens then to the politics, the history of politics in the U.S., is you go from voters representing, if you will, their families and their community, to individuals expressing their will at the ballot box. And some people have the right to do that, and some people do not. And it's only with the introduction of universal, and again, I'm using that term advisedly, suffrage in the 1830s, that politicians, or at least some politicians, feel incentivized to try and suppress the vote. And so voter suppression, I think, really becomes an issue only when there's a mass enfranchisement of individuals. Now, I think it should be said, we're skeptical about these claims of universal manhood suffrage in the 1830s in the United States, and we should be. However, if one takes a global view, far more of the citizenry were enfranchised in the United States in the 1830s than in any other part of the world at that point. So it is a significant step forward by our own lights, and we certainly know the limitations of Jacksonian America, where we treat that with skepticism. But I really think it's in your period, we're back to the Civil War, to the middle period and its aftermath, where the question of who can vote and suppressing the right to vote, particularly the issue of whether the vote should be extended to non-whites, formerly enslaved people, becomes an issue. But I kind of hand off to you to talk about that. I don't know if you have any questions about my characterization of the colonial and revolutionary periods, though.
Well, I mean, the two things that I think we should probably note is one is that voting in the United States is very much determined. Voting practices, voting regulations are done at the local level.
Yes.
And so that we, you know, the picture that emerges about voting rights, access to the ballot, is a different picture emerges depending on which state you're looking at, which community you're looking at, that there's a patchwork of developments that happen. And you can tell a narrative about voting rights in the United States in which, you know, the suffrage is gradually expanded, you know, to include all white men, and then you include African Americans, and then you include women, and then you have the Voting Rights Act, and there's a way in which you can narrate it on a national level, which is about the gradual expansion of the franchise to include much larger segment of the population than you would have had in 1776. But at the local level, the picture is often much fuzzier. It's not as linear a transformation once you sort of drill down into individual communities. And I guess the second point that I think is worth mentioning going into sort of a broader discussion about how voters get suppressed in the 19th and 20th centuries is that people who are engaging in voter suppression never call it voter suppression.
No, of course not.
You know, you always frame it in the terms of, you know, preventing vote fraud, or in terms of, you know, proper regulation and other what kinds of ways of justifying. One of the things about voter suppression laws is on face value, a lot of them look, seem justified. You know, they have the appearance of being legitimate kinds of regulations on voting. We can think about sort of voter ID laws as sort of sometimes fall in a modern example. It seems reasonable until you actually look at the effect it has in practice on voting populations. That, you know, when people are choosing, making decisions about voter ID laws, they're doing that not because, I think, if I'm going to be skeptical, as I tend to be, you know, they're doing it for a very particular political outcome. They want to make sure that certain people are less likely to vote.
You're right, David. They do it in the name of protecting the sanctity of the ballot and preventing voter fraud.
Yeah. And so we have to sort of read past that. And even some things that we now think of as being good in terms of voting practice were originally intended with the purpose of voter suppression. The big example that comes to mind is the introduction of the secret ballot in the end of the 19th century, sometimes called the Australian ballot. And, we think of the secret ballot as being one of the hallmarks of American democracy. You go into a voting booth, you're by yourself, you mark your piece of paper, or you click your switches or whatever it is. All of which is true, and all of which the advocates of the Australian ballot recommended when they were pushing for it at the end of the 19th century. But the effect that it had in some places is it discriminates against those people who can't read. And so in some localities, certain segments of the voter population basically dropped out because they couldn't access the ballot because they couldn't read the piece of paper in front of them. I think in like Arkansas, for instance, black voting went from 71% to 38% the year they introduced the Australian ballot.
Right.
So even that, we think of that as being a good invention or a modification to the voting system, because before that, you used to vote in public. It has consequences. Anytime you mess with the system, it has consequences. So thinking about, you know, voter suppression, you know, you have some. The other thing that's interesting to think about is not only, you know, you mentioned citizenship before. Definitions of who and who isn't a citizen is actually something that in the first half of the 19th century, at least, is up for debate. In as much as you don't have a definition, a constitutional definition of who's a citizen and who's not until the 14th Amendment. In some states, prior to the Civil War, they allowed non-citizens to vote if they said they were planning on becoming citizens eventually. And oftentimes, one of the big fights about access to the ballot in the 1840s and 1850s was, do you allow non-citizens to vote? Do you allow people who are recently citizens to vote? And so you have efforts by the Democrats, which were a party that largely got support from immigrant voters, especially in northern cities, they said, look, we should open up the ballot to everybody who is both a citizen and intends to be a citizen in the future and can say that they're planning on getting citizenship in the next few years. Whereas some of the Whigs and Know-Nothing said, no, we need to restrict it to people who have been citizens for a number of years so they actually understand what they're buying into. And you can make a logical argument for both of those cases, but you know, the people who are doing it with a specific end in mind. The real fights, though, I think over voter suppression really come in the aftermath of the Civil War, especially in the 1890s and afterwards. And I think imagine most of our listeners know about the rise of Jim Crow and the efforts to disenfranchise African Americans in the 1890s with poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses and that whole regime of tools to restrict the ballot. What people I think are less aware of is the similar kinds of processes are going on across the country, that there are efforts in the late 19th century to make it harder to vote. It's in the 1870s when states start to require and communities start to require voter registration, which I think 49 states now have. And voter registration in some ways is pitched as something that you do to make sure that the ballot is secure, make sure that people who are voting are eligible to vote, and all these other kinds of things. On the other hand, it does create a hoop that is easier for some people to jump over than others. And so, you know, if you introduce voter registration, in some ways that anything that makes voting harder in some ways can be an act of voter suppression, depending on how the way you design the boxes.
Which state doesn't have voter registration, David?
North Dakota.
Oh, interesting, particularly because North Dakota is one of the states in which this is now an issue.
Yeah, so actually that came up when some listeners may know I lived in North Dakota for 5 years, and I remember when we moved there going to get our driver's license. And I remember going to the driver's license office, getting the driver's license, doing the whole thing, and then leaving and mentioning to my wife as we got it, they didn't ask us if we wanted to register to vote. That's illegal because under the 1993 Motor Voter Bill, they're supposed to ask you if you want to register to vote when you get your driver's license. So I called them up and they said, oh, we don't do that here. And I said, what do you mean you don't do that here? They said, oh, we don't register people to vote here. I'm like, what century are we living in? And so, turns out North Dakota had voter registration for a while, and then they decided to get rid of it.
So is that why they want postal addresses?
So that is partially why they want postal addresses. On the official North Dakota, at least back 10 years ago when I looked at this, what their explanation for why they don't have voter registration is, we're a small town state, and if you show up to vote, and the person knows who you are, they let you vote.
Right. I see you said that with a North Dakota accent. That was very nice.
Well, for sure. Yeah. But what struck me is just bizarre in terms of somebody saying that in the 21st century, that their mechanism for knowing whether you're an eligible voter or not is whether the guy at the polling place knows who you are. But I guess in small town North Dakota, that makes some nominal bit of sense. But they're making a choice there about who they're, the systems they're using, and that has consequences. But there's ways in which you can do things like voter registration that are intended very hard to make certain people harder to vote. For instance, I found a case in San Francisco where San Francisco in the 1878 decided they wanted to make sure that only sort of permanent residents were voting, and so the way they did that was they created voter districts that were very, very small, something like 300 people, and they required people to register to vote every single year. And if you moved districts, you had to re-register. So if you moved like two blocks over, which would put you in a new district, you had to re-register to vote, all of which meant that people who were stable, people who had houses and permanent addresses, they had a much lower bar to jump over than the kind of transient population would. New York City for a while, I think it's only 1 year, in 1908, had voter registration, and it only had a certain number of days a year that you were allowed to register. And the I think almost all of them were Saturdays, except for one day, which was a Monday. But that Monday was Yom Kippur.
Okay.
So if you were an observant Jewish person, you had to make the choice about whether you're going to register to vote on the Sabbath or on Yom Kippur, or, you know, so you have to make that sort of choice. You know, and they had some sort of arbitrary reason why they picked those dates, but there's ways in which you can sort of use things we think of as being rather banal to really limit you know, who has access to the ballot box.
All of which suggests, David, that so when people are trying to protect the right to vote as they see it, or reform the electoral system, that often this comes at the expense, or part of the agenda could be to disenfranchise certain categories of people. So the example you used of New York in 1908, well, in 1908, there were tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Jewish migrants or immigrants arriving in New York and its environs annually, and the law you're talking about seems deliberately constructed as to disenfranchise them or to make it difficult for those people to vote. And yeah. So I guess the obvious lesson we're learning here, and it will be a lesson well known to you given the period you study, is that the rights of citizenship are closely bound up with race and ethnicity.
Well, I think that's obvious lesson number one of American history is you know, race and ethnicity are, you know, the key fissure in American society. But if we think about how this sort of progresses into the 20th century, obviously we have at the same time these claims about universal suffrage in the United States, you know, at the same time that all these kinds of local efforts are being put in place to limit the actual application of the vote, whether that's for African Americans in the South or other populations in other parts of the country. But if we were to sort of chronologize this, you see a shift, I think, starting in the 1960s. You have a period from, I think, 1960 or so until the mid-90s, in which you have a lot of these barriers to voting being broken down. You know, things like Baker versus Carr, a Supreme Court decision that establishes the one person, one vote rule that requires congressional redistricting so that people's votes actually matter. Obviously, the big development during this period is the Voting Rights Act in 1965, which creates federal, among other things, federal oversight of elections procedures in places that have traditionally had problems with voter suppression, especially in the South. You know, through the 26th Amendment in 1971, that expanded suffrage to 18-year-olds. So you have this period in the second half of the 20th century in which, you know, a lot of these barriers that have been constructed during the Gilded Age, barriers that have been constructed beforehand, are chipped away at. So much so, and I think, you know, the way I would chronologize this is that I think ends in some ways with the Motor Voter Bill in 1993.
Can you explain that?
Oh, so this is one of these efforts in to make it easier for people to vote, on the supposition that making it easier for people to vote is a good thing. And what the Motor Voter Bill, the official name is the National Voter Registration Act, did was it required state Department of Motor Vehicles to ask people if they wanted to register to vote when they got their driver's license, on the supposition that you don't want to create, you know, this way you don't have, if you're going to have to renew your driver's license regularly anyway, and you do, that's one of the things you do when you move to a new state or get your driver's license, this creates a mechanism for people to register to vote and make it easier. So if you remember back in 93, this is the same time that Rock the Vote is a thing. I think I still have a Rock the Vote t-shirt somewhere. You know, but what I think you've seen since then are these efforts really to restrict the ballot, often using these mechanisms that seem neutral on their face, but in practice are not. Like the situation in Georgia where, you know, the 53,000 voter registrations in question are because they've got this exact match law that says basically that if your voter registration does not exactly match some other kind of official record of what your name is, then, you know, they put your registration into a special box that you have to vote provisionally and other kinds of things. And on the
which
face
is
about,
particularly difficult for Latinos who often have hyphenated names and often have names with accent marks that the English alphabet doesn't allow for necessarily.
To be sure. Or people who, women who get married and change their name, or transgender people who change their name as a consequence. So there's lots of people who, you know, on the face value of it, that seems like a neutral thing, that your name should match your other documents. But in practice, something like 70% of those disenfranchised are effectively put on hold, if you will, by this legislation, are African Americans, and 80% are people of color. So it really does target a particular demographic or set of demographics, most of whom, almost all of whom, vote for Democrats.
Right. So I think we in the interest of full disclosure here, it should be said that most, I believe NBC News reported over the weekend that voter suppression efforts are underway in 9 states. In each of those states, and I can't remember all 9 of them off the top of my head, but in each of those states, the local officials, the state secretary of state, who's usually responsible for overseeing elections, is a Republican.
Yes.
And so what this seems to me to speaks to 2 things, and we're not being partisan in saying this. I mean, these are the facts. One is, I think the Republicans have spent more time paying attention to local and state elections over the past 40 years than Democrats. And so they control the local levers of state power. And as you stipulated at the beginning of our chat, voting is controlled at the state level or the local level. And so this is a manifestation of that. Secondly, they are using that power to a certain extent to, to uphold the sort of to maintain the sanctity of the ballot and of the vote. But it can be interpreted another way. The Secretary of State of Georgia, who's trying to disenfranchise 53,000 people, most of whom are likely to vote Democrat, is running for governor of Georgia.
Yes.
And not doing very well in the polls. It's certainly the race seems to be a toss-up. So they seem to be putting their thumbs on the scale, or their collective thumb on the scale, to benefit their side.
Yes.
Is that a fair assessment?
I think it is. I mean, in as much as the expanding access to the ballot tends to favor Democrats, in as much as people of color, people who are poor, people who are, you know, other groups that tend to be more transitory, tend to be more likely to vote Democratic, and people who are stationary and white and somewhat older, you know, tend to vote Republican. So Republicans seem to be the ones who are playing this card more, in part because it's to their electoral advantage.
But let's note the irony of that, if we can return to the Civil War for a moment, that it's representatives of the party of Lincoln, which sought in its origins to both abolish slavery and then extend full rights to African Americans, to formerly enslaved people, that are doing this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think as is pretty clear to anyone who's looked at American politics over the past 150 years, the party of Lincoln and the party of Trump have the same name and are genealogically related, but that, you know, have very little in common otherwise. What do you think are the biggest barriers to voting today? You just registered to vote in Virginia, did you not?
Yeah, I mean, I have some personal experience with this. And so as listeners, longtime listeners will know, I've got a fellowship this year. I've got a 9-month fellowship at Monticello here in Charlottesville, Virginia. And so I'm living in Virginia. And one of the first things I attempted to do was to – well, we bought a car and I had to get license plates for the car. And so I've been dealing with the state in all kinds of ways. But one of the first things I sought to do was to register to vote. And in part because for the past 26 years I voted by absentee ballot. And I voted in Massachusetts because that was the state I grew up in. But voting by absentee ballot in the United States works is because of the Electoral College, and this is something we'll talk about in another day, I'm sure. Mm. I know you're quite agitated about it from your recent tweets.
No.
but because of the way the Electoral College works, we all have to vote in a state. And so you vote in the state you were last resident in if you're abroad and vote by absentee ballot. And so this meant that for the past 26 years, I voted in Massachusetts, even though I haven't lived in Massachusetts, because you have to vote in some state. And so this was a little bit weird sometimes. Well, it was often weird because I was voting on local initiatives in Massachusetts and I wasn't a Massachusetts resident. Anyway, I now, for the next year, live in Virginia. So I went to register to vote in Virginia and I did it online. And then I discovered that it wasn't quite so simple because I don't have a Virginia driver's license. I have a UK driver's license. I have an American passport, however. So I had to fill out a different form, print it off, and mail it to the Virginia Secretary of State in Richmond, or his office, which I have done. I keep checking, and indeed today we're recording this on Monday, October 15th. Mm. Today is the deadline to register to vote in Virginia. I keep checking to see whether I'm now on the voter roll, and I don't appear to be so. But the fine print on their website says, don't worry if your name doesn't appear. This may be because you've recently registered. So mm-hmm. one can imagine that they've had a surge of registrations and they haven't kept the website up to date. That makes perfect sense. Part of the problem is, and this is more information than people want and more information than I actually want to divulge, but here I go, is I have a suffix. British listeners will laugh at this because this is very American. I'm a junior. And so I almost never use the junior in my name, except it's in my passport. And several years ago when I tried to renew my passport, I tried to drop it, and the U.S. government put it back on there. So I'm stuck with being – well, I won't give you my full name, but I'm a junior. And so as a consequence of this, every time I log on, I think, well, maybe I'm not – to check my voting status. I think maybe I'm not here because they put the junior on. Maybe I'm not there because, and so I try it with junior. Then I try it with a comma and then junior and comma junior period and all kinds of every variation. And I get confused and it's my name and it's a relatively straightforward name. I can imagine how much more complicated it could be for other folks. And so I'm fully prepared to turn up. I'm going to be away on election day, so I'm going to have to vote early. And I'm very keen. I don't want to vote by absentee ballot. I haven't cast a ballot in the United States since 1990. So I'm very, very happy and excited to go and vote in person. I don't want to miss that. So I'm going to do early voting in a week or so. But I'm fully prepared to get there and have them say to me that I'm not on the voter roll, at which point I'm going to insist on casting a provisional ballot. Now, I would say I'm a middle-aged white man and I will go there with my passport and I will insist on my right to vote, and I reckon they'll probably let me vote. But it hasn't been a straightforward process. I'll give you a little kind of addendum to this tale, which is the other night, and far more important, I went to buy a bottle of wine in the supermarket, and the woman on the till on the register said to me, "Can I see your ID?" I said, "Are you kidding me?" She said, no, yes, please." And so I took out my UK driver's license, which is the only photo ID I have on me regularly, and of course she couldn't make head or tail of it, and the birth date on my UK driver's license is done as they do it in the UK, so it's date, month, year rather than date, year. And so I had to read it to her, and she's like, "Can you just tell me when your birthday is so I can put it in?" And I said, why do you do this? And she said, well, we have to ask everybody. And I sort of had some sympathy for her. I mean, it was absurd. But I thought, well, if they ask everybody, then that means when they don't have to have an argument with a 25-year-old who's trying to buy liquor, trying to buy alcohol, or, more importantly, an 18-year-old who claims that they're a 25-year-old. So if they do it to everybody, then everybody has to produce an ID. But it seemed fairly absurd to me that
You're just very youthful looking, Frank. That's what it
well,
is.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you.
Or the person had very bad vision.
I'm considerably over 21. Let's just leave it at that. So my point being, it's not that easy to navigate in the United States, particularly if you're newly arrived in a place. You know, so one of the things I had to do to register to vote was I had to produce a copy of my lease on the apartment we're renting to prove that I live there.
Yeah.
So I will go with, and I'm prepared to go with a copy of my lease and my passport when I go to vote, as I said, in a week or so. But, you know, you have to have access to all that stuff, and you've got to be organized, and you have to have a passport or a driver's license, and et cetera. It's not as straightforward as you might think. And I've been reminded of this, I guess, in going through this myself.
Yeah. I think it's a more onerous process to register to vote in the U.S. than in lots of countries. You know, you actually do have to take active steps to make it happen. Whereas in the UK, I get a letter in the mail every year saying, nobody at your address is registered to vote. Here's your voter registration form. Please fill this out, even if no one is eligible to vote in your house. And so I have to.
And you could just add your name to it, and you could vote.
Well, no, because then I'd go to jail.
No, I understand that, but you could do it. In fact, I've been told by other Americans, oh, I vote all the time. And I said, well, you're not supposed to. It's illegal. Yeah. And I do, but you could do that.
But I have to fill out the form saying, no, nobody in this flat can vote because we're all Americans. Sorry. But, you know, there are ways in which voter registration, these processes in many countries are easier than the United States. So there's these barriers. And some of the barriers, I think, are because voting is so localized that many of these offices that handle voter registration, boards of elections, all these instruments, you know, which only really go to work in terms of, you know, doing an actual election, you know, every year, every 2 years, you know, they're often deeply underfunded, understaffed. This is an issue not only with questions on voter registration, but also in terms of you know, questions about people hacking elections that have come up recently. You know, that oftentimes the, you know, county board of elections run by three people who may not have any particular expertise other than the fact they got elected to that post. So there's these barriers. I think those are a real burden for people in order to get access to the ballot. I think these voter ID laws are really quite insidious in terms of making it harder for some people to vote. There was a case, I think it was in 2008 in the Democratic primary in Indiana, where 12 retired nuns showed up, all of whom had been voting for 50 years or something, and they were turned away from the ballot box in South Bend because they didn't have a photo ID that was not expired. And of course, these are 12 nuns who lived in a convent who didn't drive because they were all, you know, retired, and they all had to go back.
Well, but if you can imagine, you mess with nuns in South Bend at your peril. That's all.
Well, to be sure, but I mean, I guess, you know, the reason why I'm bringing up that example is you can think of, you know, dozens of other groups of people, whether they're people who don't have cars,
that's right,
you know, people who are homeless, people who are, you know, don't have photo ID for any number of reasons, but still have a legal right to vote, and are, you know, the act of getting an ID might be no barrier for some people because they already have a driver's license and all these other kinds of things. But for some other people, it's a real, you know, it's an extra hoop you have to jump through, and every hoop you have to jump through is an effective disenfranchisement or, you know, proxy to disenfranchisement.
Right. I mean, voter ID laws are a good example because, for example, in many states where they've adopted them, they won't accept a state-issued university ID. So you could go to the state university in that state, but that's not acceptable. basically because young people are tending to vote Democrat more than older people, whereas they will accept
hunting licenses.
High hunting licenses, yes, exactly.
Yeah, so, I think that's the case in Texas.
Right, which is, I would say with regard to the UK, it is, you're right, it is more inclusive and it's easier. So you and I, if we were willing to break the law, and of course we're not, could simply fill out that form and send it back and we would be on the voting roll. And all you have to do is turn up and tell them your name and you can vote. It's a little complicated in the UK because there are different, you can vote for different things.
Mm.
So my wife, who is an EU citizen but not a UK citizen, can vote in local and European elections, although there won't be many more European elections in the UK. But she can vote in local elections. She can't vote in national, in general elections. My children, who are UK nationals, EU nationals, and US nationals,
they can vote for everybody.
Well, they can, although so our son was able to vote in the Swedish general election held a few weeks ago. He can vote in all UK elections. He has difficulty voting in US elections because he's never lived in the United States. Our daughter, who spent a year in California, votes via absentee ballot in California. But also votes in the UK and can vote in Sweden now. But UK elections are complicated because there are levels of voting and some people are eligible for some and not for others.
And 16-year-olds can vote for some things but not other things.
Yeah, they're meant to vote for independence.
Exactly. That didn't work out the way they hoped. I mean, the other thing about voting that I've really noticed in terms of barriers to voting in recent elections is the access to the polling place, the number of polling places, and the hours of polling places, in some communities at least, have seemed to really contracted. You know, one of the disincentives for voting is if you have to wait in line for 2 or 3 hours and drive an hour or half an hour to get there, that makes it much harder for people to vote. You know, one of the things about voting in the United States that's different from other places necessarily is it does take a long time. Especially, you know, in some places, the United, people don't get the day off for voting the way they do in some countries. And if you're working 2 or 3 jobs, you may not have time off to actually get to the ballot box. And it's not something you can do during your lunch hour if you have to wait for 2 hours to vote. And there were some pretty outrageous lines, I think, in the last 3 or 4 election cycles. I think that's a real barrier to voting at the moment.
That's right. And in a lot of continental European countries, of course, the elections are held on weekends. They're held on Sundays to mitigate against some of that. But you're right. That's another aspect of the way in where the vote is being restricted in the United States. So the franchise is being restricted. And whereas in other contexts, you know, they've got polling stations in nursing homes and things like that. So they make it easy for some people to vote, but not for others.
Yeah, and it's hard to, you know, they make arguments about why they're doing that. There was a case, I want to say it was in Georgia, where they said, oh, look, these aren't handicapped accessible, but they're the same polling places that have been used for 30 years and only bringing it up now at this very last minute to try to close certain polling places. And I guess that the last huge barrier, and I think this is one that the United States really is going to have to wrestle with, is the situation with felon disenfranchisement. Because the United States is in some ways very different from almost all other democracies, in as much as it doesn't allow people who have committed crimes and have served their prison sentences from voting. And this is, it varies from state to state about how hard it is to get your voting rights back if you are a convicted felon. But in some states, it's nearly impossible. In Florida, in Virginia, in Kentucky, other places, if you have been convicted of even a relatively minor felony, you've basically been disenfranchised for the rest of your life, which puts the United States at odds with Canada and France and Germany and pretty much every other democracy, many of whom not only allow former felons to vote, in some countries you're allowed to vote from prison on the supposition that your right to vote doesn't get you know, is inherent to your citizenship that doesn't, you know, leave you when you lose your freedom. And this has a huge impact in some states. I think something like 10% of the eligible voting population in Florida can't vote because they have a felony on their record.
Which, again, is why, I mean, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, I think, with in terms of the nomination of Justice Kavanaugh, that vote on the Supreme Court is so important, because I think there's a pending case about the enfranchisement of felons and former felons in Florida that's likely to come before the Supreme Court.
And I think there's something on the ballot actually this year about trying to re-enfranchise some of them.
That's right.
I think
it's
that's a major
initiative.
And when you consider that, you know, the way in which the criminal justice system in the United States has both now and historically discriminated against minorities and the poor, you know, this is in effect sort of disenfranchising a whole class of people. There's a whole communities in which, you know, access to the ballot is restricted. And I think that's a, you know, if we want to think about how a functioning democracy should work, you know, having free and open access to the ballot, I think is one of the fundamental tenets of that. And I think we're very much in a moment of retraction there, or at least where it seems as if voting is getting harder and harder every year.
Yes, and this may well be an issue, will certainly be an issue in the midterms in a couple of weeks' time and in 2020. So we may well be returning to this, I suspect. I will say, I would say one. I want to make one observation, which is I want to give a shout out to my mother, who's now deceased, but for years and years and years, and my mother had a particular, rather dearly held partisan affiliation, which I won't reveal. But what she also did that kind of superseded that was she worked for the League of Women Voters.
Hmm.
And the League of Women Voters is a kind of nonprofit organization dedicated, it was a women's organization, or is a women's organization, dedicated to ensuring free and fair elections. And so she volunteered at elections in my hometown almost every election. And she worked at the polls for sort of 12 hours a day, checking people in and administering elections. And she thought this was incredibly important work. Now, this was a suburb in Massachusetts. There wasn't a lot of voter fraud that she encountered or was aware of. But she said, you know, if the elections aren't free and fair, nothing else matters. And that's always kind of stayed with me. So your mother's always right, but my mother was certainly right about that.
Yeah, I'm not going to comment on the rightness or wrongness of mothers.
okay, my mother was always right, David.
Okay. So the one final point I wanted to make also is when we've been talking about voter suppression in terms of the legal mechanisms that have been used to make it more difficult for people to vote. But you know, when you look at the points in time in which these mechanisms were used most extensively, they also tend to correspond with times in which violence at the polls or threats of violence at the polls also served as a means of voter suppression. And those two things often go hand in hand. So when we think about the, you know, fights over who has access to the polls in the 1840s and 1850s, if you think about the same fights that happened in the 1890s, the early part of the 20th century, those are places where you actually have people killing each other at polling places. And one of the things I worry about, and I worry about a lot of things, with this current round of voter suppression, if we can call it that, and I'm happy to call it that, is that that's going to leak into violence at the polls. And that's going to really taint, if you will, the outcomes of these elections. You know, when somebody shows up to the polls and is told they're not allowed to vote by somebody, what's going to happen then? What's going to happen when someone shows up to vote and somebody else challenges their right to vote? You know, and I'm hoping that this coming midterm election happens and everyone's happy with the, at least the process, if not the results of the midterms. But I'm worried that that may not be the case. All right, that's a depressing note. Frank, let's do some endorsement. What's your last drop?
I've got two related last drops, David. Both are they're related to each other, and they're also related to previous things we've talked about. So the first is I mentioned my visit, a visit I made to Monticello a few weeks ago for a Tom Talk at Twilight. I returned to Monticello over the weekend with some friends from Scotland who'd never been there and knew very little about Jefferson, and we had a wonderful visit. But we went to see the new exhibition space dedicated to Sally Hemings, Thomas Jefferson's the mother of six of Thomas Jefferson's children, an enslaved woman at Monticello. And we had a look at the space that Monticello has dedicated to Sally Hemings, as well as to something called the Getting Word Project, which is an oral history of those descended from – it's a project to collect the oral histories of those descended from enslaved people at Monticello. And it's absolutely – I wasn't able to see it the last time I went. Absolutely fabulous. It was – dedicated and opened in June of this year. And if you haven't been to Monticello to see that, or haven't been to Monticello recently, I can strongly commend it to you. It's very, very powerful. And the panels there, the language on the panels deals with some very, very tough issues, particularly coercion and rape and things like this. It's a really, really, really powerful space. The other thing I would say, which relates to another famous African-American from the 19th century, is there's going to be a plaque put up on the house where Frederick Douglass stayed in Edinburgh in the 1840s. You mentioned the new exhibition on Frederick Douglass at the National Library of Scotland.
Last week.
And just after that exhibition opened, it was announced by the organization that runs Historic Scotland that they will be putting a plaque on the house where Frederick Douglass stayed on Gilmore Place in Edinburgh, which is very close to where I happen to live.
And not far from where I live. Also.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's about
equidistant between our places.
Exactly. Yeah. But I walk past it most days, and the address has been revealed now, so I'm happy to do so. It's 33 Gilmore Place was where Frederick Douglass stayed. We also need to credit our colleague Celeste Marie Bernier, who's a professor in the School of Languages, Literature, and Culture, because she is an expert on Frederick Douglass and has been a driving force behind a lot of this activity in Edinburgh related to Douglass.
Great.
What about you, David?
Okay, so I got three things. I guess I'm...
Yeah, the last drop has really become a six-pack, hasn't it?
that's okay. So the first is a dissertation prize. I know a lot of our listeners are undergraduates or graduate students, and this is a dissertation prize that's put on by Branch, the British American 19th Century Historians group that I mentioned last week. They had their annual conference, but it's open to anyone who wrote a dissertation on the long 19th century, so from 1789 to 1917. And basically, all you have to do is submit your either undergraduate or postgraduate dissertation. If you finished from a UK university last year, and you can win a prize, and there's a little bit of cash involved, and they often publish these in their journal. So for early career academics who want to get their name out there, that's one way to do it. Item number two, it's very different from a dissertation prize. I got recommended earlier today a video game. For those of you who are like video games, and we had a recent episode on video games, but this is a video game that's put out by the George Bush 41 Presidential Library Museum. You didn't think they were a video game producer.
Yes, one of the great game makers of our time.
Exactly. but it is called White House Dinner Dash. And the premise of the game is you are President George Herbert Walker Bush, and you are hosting a state dinner for various foreign dignitaries, and you have to arrange the menu and seating chart and silverware and all the kinds of things, and you have to make sure all the people have enough water or wine and get their dessert and other kinds of things. I've only played it for about an hour, but it's maybe not even that long.
You played it for an hour, David? Come on.
It was during my lunch break, and it was work, Frank. I was trying to see if this was worthy of endorsement or not. You know, you can't make light endorsements. But, you know, if you're looking for a cartoony version of President George Herbert Walker Bush, and who isn't, it's very odd that they would pick this for to be the video game outreach part of their presidential library. You would think it would be something about invading Iraq or something. But so be it. So White House Dinner Dash.
And who recommended that to you?
So Sarah Thompson, who is one of our PhD students here at Edinburgh, recommended it to me, and you know, she does that era. She does Reagan and Bush and stuff in her doctoral research. The top level, by the way, which I have not yet reached in this game, is inviting Putin for dinner. And my final drop, if you will, this week is a note of congratulation to Catherine Bateson, who it might be familiar to podcast listeners. She is the person who does the end credit voice at the end that tells us who we are and how to get in touch with us. But she has been a doctoral student here for several years, and last week handed in her final version of her thesis and got the official confirmation that she received her degree. So she's now Dr. Catherine Bateson, and I just wanted to throw out a congratulations to her on here, especially since her voice shows up every week at the end of the show.
Okay, David, speak to you soon.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.